central bank digital currencies, digital IDs, artificial intelligence, and big tech surveillance. What does our digital future really look like? Join me, Alistair Harding, for a look into our digital future every Wednesday on Paul Brennan's Breakfast Show, right here on Reality Check Radio. Welcome to another episode of Our Digital Future. My name is Alistair Harding, and so far on Our Digital Future, over the past few weeks, we've learned about how our digital footprints are tracked and surveilled on a global scale, and how central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs, like the one being proposed here in New Zealand by our Reserve Bank, could be used for the same surveillance purposes. And how central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs like the one being proposed here in New Zealand by our Reserve Bank, could be used for the same surveillance reasons and have dangerous sovereignty and privacy questions to them that need to be discussed and solved, but are being ignored by our mainstream corporate media. And so last week on Our Digital Future, our conversation also turned to digital IDs. In particular, we spoke to Farzan Irani, who's in India right now, and he told us all about how the Aadhaar digital ID has become virtually impossible to live without for Indians, even though it's been legislated that it should never be compulsory. And that's a key point, because at every step along this journey, learning about our digital future, we've discovered potential dystopian uses for the digital technology we're being forced into, like the CBDCs and the digital IDs. Yet while all those in power tell us that they'd promise never to use those things in those dystopian ways, in short, the Indian experience with the Aadhaar card proves otherwise, that in a virtual world, even digital IDs that are legislated to be voluntary can become virtually compulsory as well. And you can hear that episode and all the others in this series in our replays section at the Reality Check Radio website and app. But for this week, I've invited back on Jodie Brunning to look further into this topic about digital IDs, but from our New Zealand perspective, because in her work with Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility, she's researched the digital IDs case here in New Zealand, and she joins me now to talk about that. So welcome to the show, Jodie Brunning.
Thank you, Alistair. Just great to be here again.
Okay, so last week we heard from Farzan over in India, and he told us all about the Aadhaar card, which is their digital ID. And he shared with us that even though it's been legislated to be voluntary, it's become virtually compulsory. How far are we away from that sort of situation here in New Zealand?
Our digital ID is called Real Me Identity, and it's administered by the Department of Internal Affairs. And Real Me is increasingly not voluntary for many people. So I tend to see it more as a staggered launch. They're onboarding Real Me in a staggered way. So we're seeing university students really seeing that Real Me is the main way to apply for university. We're seeing government employees not really seeing other ways where it's easy to apply for a government job. I couldn't get Pokies funding for the charity I'm a trustee of without a Real Me identity. Farmers who own firearms have absolutely no choice. They have to register all their firearms. They can only register it with a Real Me identity. If they don't register their firearms, they face a $10,000 bill. So I really believe this is absolutely compulsory. So it really is compulsory for any farmer with a firearm to get a Real Me identity. Then if you want to go through the Ministry for Business, Innovation and Employment, employment mediation, you require Real Me identity for that. If you're an outsider wanting to apply for a visitor visa, you have to apply for it. So there's an increasing scope group that are being captured by and having to compulsorily sign up to Real Me, I do believe.
So what sort of information does the Real Me system have on it at the moment? What's it all linking together at the moment?
So digital ID or Real Me is essentially proof of who you are online. It's a remote identity verification, I guess, service. And the DIA administer it, you know, using two different acts. One is the Electronic Identity Verification Act 2012, and the other one is the Digital Identity Trust Framework Act. Then that comes into power in July 2024. When you sign up, there's sort of different ways that they sort of co-connect it with your passport or your driver's license to check that the biometric data that you provide using a selfie from your phone or your computer, and that selfie has to have a very good image of your iris, and that biometric data will be double checked, I believe, against passport or driver's license records, and apparently that information won't be kept. Now, that it's interesting because it used to be that you could get Real Me through the post shop, but that was very low. So that's when they made it so that you could only get it, you could get it online, because a lot of people would drop out when they got to the stage where they had to go to the post shop. That's why it's an online service now.
I guess one of the reasons why a lot of New Zealanders are worried about digital IDs here is the experience we just had with the COVID vaccine passes. They used that as a tool that was able to lock us out of New Zealand, lock us out of cafes and restaurants and bars and shopping centres and doctors' offices and everything. If you can connect all of this information up together, what's stopping them doing it again? What kind of laws are in place to stop them using it as a tool of control?
Well, at the moment, there's a privacy impact assessment. It's a report called Identity Check. It was released in May 2023. And in that, they say that identity check information is not information that can be shared under any of the DIA, Department of Internal Affairs, led Asia's information sharing agreements across government. But however, that same report also advises that the information from the identity check service can be provided to law enforcement agencies such as New Zealand Police or the Serious Fraud Office, and this would occur via maintenance of the law exception in the Privacy Act for voluntary disclosures, but also compulsory disclosures could occur via production orders under the Search and Surveillance Act 2012 and court orders. So it's a little bit wobbly, and it depends on us just making a sentence to say they're not doing it. But this is the problem that we might get into, but there's no governing body that is actually looking at that. The Privacy Commissioner has only $2 million to spend on checking out if privacy is being, the Privacy Act's being sort of abused. So they really don't have enough money or resources. And the Digital Identity Services Trust Framework Act, you know, that's a pretty toothless act from the get-go.
I would tell us about that act. That was passed, what, last year? Or it's coming into power this year, isn't it?
Yes, so it's coming into power next month, and it will create rules and regulatory oversight to help people and businesses prove who they are in a secure and efficient way so they can access services, transact, and generally live and work in a digital world. So it's really looking at the corporations that will want to use these services, and then it's looking at the people that will go to the corporations to use the services. And that, you know, that bill at the start was very narrowly configured. The framework principles were very shallowly drafted. The public were excluded from early consultation, you know. And Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility, we put in a fairly large submission to this, and, you know, most people were roundly ignored. 4,500 people were submitted and 4,049 were dismissed by the select committee.
How is that possible? Why were they dismissed?
Well, because I think they used the word that they were speaking outside the text, you know, of the bill, so they weren't really relevant. None of these ideas are related to the content of the bill. So when people were talking, comparing the bill to the social credit systems, to centralised state control of identity, and the problem of moving to a cashless society, they were saying, well, these concerns are outside the text of the bill, so they're not relevant. And select committees do that a heck of a lot. It's a very good way of, undermining the consultation process. You know, it's quite shocking, really. And then they don't summarise. So in a lot of these select committees consultations, they don't give people an opportunity to say yes or no. So people might protest and they're like, well, but you're not responding to our questions. But they actually never give people a black and white, you know, capacity was to say yes or no. That authority is problematic because there's no at arm's length funding from the Department of Internal Affairs, who administers the Act, to provide the new authority, who will be the regulator, with autonomous inquisitorial powers. And so if you look at the fact that, for example, you know, there's big corporations that are supporting the DIA, for example, Daon, who supply the algorithms, and Google Analytics, who are used to track access and use of the various web pages. So we really, you know, there's no capacity under the Digital Identity Services Trust Framework Act to check whether Daon is, you know, really promising that they will not share information from New Zealand citizens.
Okay, so it's voluntary now, but is there any sign that it would be used in the future for some of these things that we need to do to be, let's say, responsible law-abiding citizens, like a driver's license, perhaps?
Well, so, for example, now if you wanted to update your driver's license online, you know, you can use a Real Me identity to do it and it'll be much easier. So there is the capacity for the government to say you can only renew your driver's license if you've got a Real Me identity. There's nothing to stop them doing that.
So there's nothing in that law that was passed, this Digital Identity Services Trust Framework Act, there's nothing in that to say that they can't make it compulsory?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. And, you know, in Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibilities paper, Stepping Back from the Brink, the Programmable Ledger, we looked at, you know, the background and the development of digital identities. And at the end of it, we came to the conclusion that it's really, really, really important that there should be choice for the public, that the public should be able to access, you know, use other forms of ID. So we said the government agencies should equally accept traditional identification, passports and driver's license in parallel with digital IDs, and should not, through the design of policy or online internet portals, favour digital IDs over traditional primary forms of identification. And we know, because, you know, we put in an official information act request, that there's a very low rate of fraud of passport and driver's license details. We know that many authorities already have our, you know, many authorities will have my phone number, they will have my email address. And so, you know, you can do those, you can follow those verification processes. Say you're at the hospital, they've got your phone number and email address. They can verify using two different ways before they, you know, send the data to one of those ways, that, you know, one of those information through one of those routes. And it doesn't need to be that complex that you actually have to completely sign up for a Real Me identity in order to do anything. So, for example, the portal that I do believe that Federated Farmers and the hunting and shooting, you know, lobby group should be actually petitioning Parliament so that the portal where they sign up and provide all their gun information should equally allow them to provide a passport number or their driver's license information instead of Real Me. I believe it's shocking that that they are being forced to sign up to Me.
What's the benefit that these digital IDs have that we can't do without? What's the benefit we're being sold here?
I mean, I over the long term, I guess it's an efficiency thing, but it's really interesting. There was a university, New York University of School of Law 2022 paper called A Primer on the Role of the World Bank and Global Networks in Promoting Digital ID, because what we've seen, and we talk about this in Chapter 7 of the PSGR paper, is that, you know, it's the World Bank and all these private fintech corporations and banking actors have really set up the language and the principles around, you know, how we think about benefit. So they're sort of saying that there's benefits, but this paper says the purported benefits remain mostly unsubstantiated in the absence of serious baseline studies, cost benefit and value for money analysis and impact assessments. So there's certainly been no independent impact assessment in New Zealand outside of the DIA that looks at the potential for us to use our existing identity, which has a very low rate of fraud instead. And so what this paper also says, you know, what these actors, these networks of actors are doing, they're collectively manufacturing a new consensus around digital ID, and they dress it in the language of development goals and rights. So that's how they sort of say it's amazing because we're going to increase, you know, inclusivity. But really, we're seeing a lot of, like, there was an example on online where there was this old farmer trying to sign up to do the right thing, you know, list all his firearms. It was on Rotorua Daily Post in August 2023. And he just really struggled to do the real me identity stuff. But we know, for example, that NZTA or AA equally could be that place, or the post office. We've got three different government, you know, facing institutions where any old person could rock up with their driver's license or their passport, and they could be double checked in there, and they could do all that same work. We shouldn't need to force people onto Real Me. And I really do recommend, if they haven't listened to that Farzan interview, you know, on looking at Ardu and the example where it's absolutely so, you know, the Indian experience shows that it is absolutely not voluntary. And actually, hilariously, Pauline Hanson in Australia has put out a very funny comic. If you look up her Twitter handle and find out, and there's a very funny comedy on how voluntary digital ID really is, in, you know, but hashtag it isn't.
And for those people, those listeners who haven't heard that interview, that was last week's episode of Our Digital Future. You can see that on the replays on realitycheck.radio or on the app. Have a listen to it, because what that was Farzan Irani, our regular RCR contributor, telling us all about what it's like to actually live in India without an Aadhaar card, which turns out to be practically impossible, even though by law it is a voluntary ID system. Nobody's supposed to tell anybody that they have to have it, but it's driven by the corporations, isn't it, Jody? It's not driven by the government telling people that it's compulsory. It's driven by private corporations, companies, telling people, if you want to use our service, you have to have an Aadhaar card. And that's essentially how it works. And that's how it worked during COVID as well, right? It wasn't a law which told everybody they needed to be injected with the vaccinations. It was the companies telling people that if you want to work here, you have to be injected with it. And it's the same game plan, is it not?
Absolutely. And if we go back to the Aadhaar card, that there was a court case that said that Farzan talks about, that people cannot be compelled into this. But when the only way that the energy companies will let you sign up for electricity is with the Aadhaar card, it's absolutely compulsory. And, you know, we've got the Dayon is the company that supplies the sort of the algorithm that enables the DIA to do the passive liveness testing. And, you know, Dayon is in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Dayon launched the VeriFly app, and in 2022 that app was used by cruise lines and airlines to digitally process passenger health information and complete the vaccination verification process. So the government's key colleague in that has enabled the government to turn this into turn RealMe into an online engine is provided by this corporation that already has all these, you know, all this capability.
Okay, so who's driving this within New Zealand and also externally outside New Zealand? Who are the major players that are actually driving the digital ID development in New Zealand?
Okay, in New Zealand, the Department of Internal Affairs, through those two different acts we talked about, are driving this. And the Department of Internal Affairs is ginormous. So in 2011, they had $0.3 billion of a budget. And 11 years later, in 2022, they have $1.2 billion. They've grown their budget by $1 billion in 10 years.
This is the Department of Internal Affairs.
They're tremendously powerful. And so because they administer both this digital, ID Trust Services Trust Framework Act and the Electronic Identity Verification Act, they've just got so much power. The governance board and the supervisory, the potential for any, you know, authority or regulator should be outside the DIA, and it's not.
There's another part to this as well, isn't there, that Judith Collins, who heads up the DIA, is also in a position of power in a few other places as well, isn't she? And I know that's a bugbear of yours.
It's tremendously important that we ask our most sceptical friends, and I said this to Leighton Smith on his News Talk ZB podcast. So Judith Collins is the Attorney General. So, you know, this is the person who's responsible for that the operations of executive government are conducted lawfully and constitutionally, and the government is not prevented through the use of legal process from lawfully implementing its chosen policies, right? But she is also, now listen and listen carefully, folks, she's the Minister for Digitising Content. She's the Minister for Defence. She's the Minister for the GCSB. She's the Minister for the NZSIS. She's the minister who is leading the coordination of the government's response to the Royal Commission's report into the terrorist attack on the Christchurch mosques. She's the Minister for Science, Innovation and Technology, and she's the Minister for Space. And now when you hear about science and innovation and technology, that sort of includes a lot of MB staff, but it's also she's the minister for any funding for research. So if you are looking at, if you are a scientist or researcher in New Zealand looking for a long-term funding proposal to understand whether, you know, digital IDs potentially impact human rights, such as that NYU School of Law paper, the primer on the role of the World Bank, said, if you are a scientist or researcher, do you think that that minister for digitising the whole of New Zealand is going to have any policies there, any ways that you can get funding that will do anything that will contradict the government's chosen position on the safety and the necessity of digital IDs across New Zealand? I doubt that will happen. And I do believe that she has so many ministerial portfolios that she cannot possibly not be biased in her approach to what she's trying to achieve. I really just don't think there's much room there for wriggle room for consideration of human rights and civil and constitutional rights.
talking about considerations, what considerations have you seen in the discussion documents about the sensibilities of putting all of the all of this private data of New Zealanders into a digital system which can be hacked? I mean, that's one of the things that we found out about the Aadhaar card in India, that it's been hacked and over 800 million people's personal information has been sold on the dark web because of that. Is there any evidence of this sort of thing being considered by the people who are driving all of this digital ID infrastructure here in New Zealand? Because it seems to me a really dangerous proposition to actually be doing this.
Look, I really find it hard to see that, because the agencies with the interest in getting the job done aren't really interested. So there's very, very few sort of risk assessments, and they're all done by the DIA. And so there's a company called Datacom that, you know, that is responsible for storing and managing the data. And so they're a Kiwi company, which is great. But we don't know how good and how rigorous they are and how much investment they have put into troubleshooting. And we also know that their Datacom's cloud identity integrator is a cloud offering that provides a streamlined RealMe integration service for client applications. So I can only guess vaguely from that sentence that they're also providing some of their services across to the private sector. So I don't know where this stuff starts or stops, but I guess, Alistair, I grew up very conservatively, and I was always taught not to put all your eggs in one basket, you know, and I really, really, really believe that, you know, a sort of a distributed identity system where we've got, you know, we need to supply three or four different sources of identity for this one thing that is outside government surveillance, and then I think that is really safe. I think the government actually has the capacity to fund walk-in situations in already existing infrastructure to ensure that people who don't want to get RealMe identity should be able to not get RealMe identity. So I think, you know, RealMe identity is a thing, and it's going to be a thing and stay. But I think there should be choice for citizens to not have to. If you want a government job, you shouldn't have to sign up to RealMe Identity. If you want to get funding through the Pokies grant for your community charity, you shouldn't have to sign up. If you want to go through MB and, you know, go through employment mediation, you shouldn't need a RealMe Identity to sign up to that either. I think we can do better in terms of making sure that, you know, because we need to look at what can happen over the long term. So, of course, I'm sort of interjecting here, because when we think about technology over in the future, we're always allowed to think about how good technology will be in the future, how great it will be, how it will improve everything, how the robots will service and do all those terrible jobs. It's sort of like we're permitted to think about the good things, but we're not allowed to think about how human rights might be affected by digital ID systems. And, you know, that NYU paper said that they believe that health can be impacted, that name and nationality can be impacted, that freedom of movement can be impacted, that housing can be impacted, that free expression and association can be impacted, that dignity, that social security, that equal treatment and non-discrimination can be impacted, as well as privacy and data protection and food. So they see that human rights can potentially be impacted across all these sort of things. And they've got a great image that we've cut and pasted into our paper just to show you that, how it could be really, really big. But of course it's nebulous, and because all this stuff is black boxed in government coffers, we can't know when the mission creep or the failure occurs. So it's a big risk if you centralize everything and have everything in this digital wallet that potentially can be surveilled if the police or if the surveillance and intelligence service deem it necessary.
Why do you think there's so little discussion about this issue in the New Zealand media, just in the New Zealand public space, full stop.
Yes, and before this interview, Alistair, I did go back and I looked on New Zealand Herald, I looked on Scoop and stuff you can't do a search from what I understand, and Newsroom and RNZ, and there's absolutely no critical discussion. And we see this again and again when it comes to technologies that are positioned by the government as being, inverted commas, safe and effective. And we see this complete failure of imagination. Phil Pennington and RNZ sometimes does some good stuff, but apart from him, I really haven't seen anyone out there that is consistently able to sort of critically look at what the government are doing. And Phil's limited too, because I'm pretty sure RNZ really aren't going to discuss this too much. So it's an utter failure to inform, because this is the fourth estate, and functioning democracies are inherently dependent on their citizens being informed, and citizens cannot be informed right now. They simply can't.
We've also seen something about this last week. You mentioned Radio New Zealand. They put out a two-part series on the M5 network this last week, which is an extension of the Five Eyes Intelligence Partnership. And what they're doing essentially is sharing digital data for immigration and visa purposes. And it started off with, you know, just a few queries, but it's been expanded again and again and again. And it just shows there's massive scope for mission creep that just gets out of control fast, isn't there? In all of these digitization programs.
Absolutely. So it looks like it started off being, you know, worthy for persons of concern, and then it just expands out. And because of the scalability of digital technology, that is the problem. That is, and these agencies and authorities, we naturally like being important. We like, you know, doing the most newest, most important thing. And this is sort of the problem for democracies. We need to know how to regulate and pull back when an agency is out of control. And so I would like people to try to understand what the budget of, like the New Zealand's budget for the GCSB or the NZSIS budgets are, because I don't think they're declared. So there's a potential for these budgets to expand, to keep going, and no one knows how much money is being spent on this surveillance and how this might completely become out of control. And again, Jeff Palmer and Butler said in 2018 in their book that the New Zealand's, you know, style of governance is authoritarian. And we're increasingly just seeing an absence of accountability and an absence of, and we don't have a constitution to protect our broader civil and constitutional rights. You know, we've got human rights through BORA, but that is really fragile. You know, so it's very concerning, really.
I think one of the things that unnerves me most about this is that none of this digitization of our lives, be it CBDCs or digital IDs, none of it actually seems to be driven by public demand, which really, in a democratic society, you'd think that it should be. And I know that it's not being driven by popular demand, because we don't have anyone talking about it in the media. And when we do, it's always driven by some sort of government press release or a research paper or something like that. And so it seems to me that it's being driven by bureaucracy and also global organizations that we've signed up to that are also a big part of this discussion as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, Alistair, that they say that, you know, between 0.5 and 3% of GDP is the value of introducing digital IDs to New Zealand. So roughly $1.5 to $9 billion in NZD. But we do wonder what the cost to democracy and to choice and human rights and free will might be. And this is over time. So again, we must give ourselves permission to ask whether technology will not only be amazing and awesome over time, but whether there is the chance that the technology will disadvantage us over time. And, you know, we're seeing this in, you know, iPhones, in phone addiction, in pesticides and all these other things. So I think we can talk about this in relation to digital IDs and real me.
Thank you very much for your time, Jody. I mean, this is one of those things where mission creep is the words that just keep coming into my mind. We've seen it in India already, the way that it's supposed to be voluntary, but it's just mission creep. Mission creep becomes basically mandatory in everything but law. And I can see the same thing happening here, and I can see it all being linked to our CBDCs and the CBDC that they're trying to launch as well. And we need to discuss this stuff, don't we?
We can't know when harm happens. Will it be a crisis or an emergency? And I think it's important to start talking about the fact that Real Me is not voluntary for many people, that this is really a staggered launch, and we need to understand a little bit more about why can't we, you know, use our passports or our driver's licenses and use verification through phone numbers or through email addresses. I think it's really simple. We can start asking those questions.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Jody.
Lovely to talk.
That's Jody Brunning from Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility talking to us about the state of play with digital IDs here in New Zealand as part of RCR's Our Digital Future series. And you can find all our episodes in this series in the replay section of the Reality Check Radio website and app. And that includes interviews with international names like Dr. Robert Epstein, who spoke to us about Google's surveillance and manipulation on a global scale. And also Catherine Austin Fitz, who explained the rather tyrannical dangers of CBDCs that are being promoted and implemented all over the world right now. And over the coming weeks, we'll be adding more to this series. But in the meantime, my name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to Our Digital Future only on Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.